Blessed are you when people... Oh, please rise or stand as you're able for the reading of the gospel. Blessed are you when people revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. The word of the Lord.
Perhaps one of our longest Old Testament passages that we encounter in this narrative lectionary. Thanks, Sarah. Let us pray. Holy and gracious God, as we come into this place this morning, still our hearts and our minds. From the busyness of our lives, the things and tasks that need to be done, that we might hear a word of good news, that you are with us. May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be pleasing to you, O Lord, our God, our rock, and our Redeemer. Amen. So in seminary, I had this professor who was extremely committed to the importance of worship and liturgy for shaping our faith and practice. It was so important to him that in some ways he was almost fundamentalist about his commitment to liturgy and of course, liturgy done rightly as he understood it. And to be sure, at times it felt too much, if not way too much, almost getting in the way of his ability to actually just worship, because he was always thinking about how it could have been done differently or maybe should have been done differently or better. But his commitment to liturgy and worship for all of that as a transforming act of worship heavily shaped my own appreciation for it. And I tell you all of that so that you get a sense of how seriously he approached his understanding of liturgy, because it helps set the stage for this next story. Because every class he would open up and start class, he would hold out his hands and say, "The Lord be with you." We would dutifully respond. Exactly. You know, kind of like we pass the peace every week here. And then he would launch into his lecture, whatever it was for the day. And for him, this was an important liturgical act, a meaningful way to begin. And I'm sure for some of us, the students, it probably felt like a very seminary kind of appropriate way to begin class. And of course, for others, I'm sure it was just something we said every class. It became part of the routine almost. And I suppose just as good as any other way to start a seminary class, right? Perhaps that is sometimes how it feels when we do that every week for the passing of the peace, "The Lord be with you." It becomes part of the routine. And we don't necessarily pay attention to it. It's just something we do, and it seems like a good way to just move the service along. But I'll never forget the day when, as part of a presentation, one of my fellow students, after a couple of months of having our professor do this, said something to the effect of, as part of his presentation, said, "I kind of have a hard time taking it seriously when people in church say, 'The Lord be with you.' Because I just feel like it's something we do, and we don't really mean it. It's not authentic. We do it so casually that it doesn't really mean anything." And I remember thinking to myself, "What are you doing, dude?" I probably thought dude in my head. It was like one of those moments when someone drops a bomb off and you're just waiting for the reaction, what's going to come next. And I looked at my professor to see how he was responding, because for him it was an important liturgical act, a meaningful way to begin. And I remember looking at him, and I knew that for him, as I looked at him, these words were not just some shtick to get class started, and I could instantly tell that this comment had impacted him. And at some point in the class, the two of them had a follow-up conversation for all of us. And it was a somewhat intense conversation, seminary kind of intense, about liturgy and words and authenticity, during which my professor said, "No, I mean it. I really do. Every time I say it, I mean it. The Lord be with you." Our story today of Joseph and Potiphar's wife is bookended by two parts of the story that almost go out of their way to make sure that we know that God was with Joseph. Before and after Joseph's encounter with Potiphar's wife, we are told more than once. It feels a little repetitive, as Sarah noted before worship. We're told more than once that God was with Joseph. This particular part of the story unfolds after Joseph had been thrown into a well by his brothers and then sold into slavery because his brothers were angry that their father, Jacob, seemed to love Joseph the most, treated him the best, and that Joseph kept having these dreams that suggested that his brothers would all bow down and worship him. I don't understand why they were upset about all of this. After he was sold into slavery, Joseph was taken down to Egypt, where he was sold again into the house of Potiphar, an officer in Pharaoh's army. And so there he was, having been sold into slavery not once but twice, once by his own flesh and blood, and then sold again, forced to serve in a foreign land. It's hard to imagine how tragically horrible this experience was for Joseph. We don't get a lot in the text about that, but these had to have been some of the darkest and loneliest moments of his life. This is definitely not how he thought this was all going to go. This is not what the dreams he had told him about what was going to happen. How could he have been so foolish to believe these dreams? And it's just in this moment when perhaps we begin to get this sense that hope is lost, that this is the end of Joseph's story, that we hear those words that are so full of grace. The Lord was with Joseph. And we are told that somehow against the odds, Joseph prospered in Egypt, in Potiphar's house. But really, the hits do just keep coming for him. Because next we hear of this encounter with Potiphar's wife. Joseph wouldn't sleep with her, and so she gins up a story of him trying to take advantage of her. And Potiphar, enraged, has him immediately thrown into prison. And once again, Joseph finds himself in a terrible and unspeakable situation. Locked up, imprisoned for something he did not do. And once again, we hear those words of grace. But the Lord was with him and showed him steadfast love. Now, there's at least a couple reasons why this story makes me a little uncomfortable. And for starters, in varying degrees, I know that many of our stories here involve moments and experiences of darkness and loneliness and hardness and mess. And I know that sometimes a story like this can be used more as weapon than as comfort, more as judgment than grace. If you just had been a little bit more faithful like Joseph, if you had just trusted more like Joseph, God would bless you and you too would be prospering. This somehow ends up making those hard and messy seasons of life our fault, even a result of our own lack of faith. But it's important for me to say that there is nothing good about that kind of news. Many years after the fact, I learned that one of the times that my dad had cancer as I was growing up, a relative had sent a letter to my parents suggesting that it must have been something my dad had done or that his faith was just not strong enough. That must be why he had cancer. They since apologized for that letter, but still, in the moment, the damage was done. But this kind of thing happens all the time. And I guess I kind of get why we do this. I mean, let's be honest. We don't always really know what to do with suffering. We don't understand it always when we struggle or exactly how to respond when people find themselves in these seasons. It just doesn't make sense sometimes. I mean, where is God in this? And so we desperately try to impose some sense of logic onto it, some sense of rational reason. We attribute those experiences to God, that God is doing something to us, or at the very least allowing these things to happen because of something we did or didn't do, or to teach us a lesson of some sort of morality lesson, Or maybe we attribute them to the person because it's something they've done. As I said, if only they had had more faith. But I think to have that be what we take away from a story like this is to miss the point, perhaps entirely. Because this isn't a story about why those things happened to Joseph. I think it's pretty clear that injustice is real, people are broken, we can do some pretty horrible things to one another. History is full of these kinds of stories. In many ways, this isn't a story about why Joseph was thrown into prison, sold into slavery. It's a story in which Joseph becomes the vessel through which we come to understand who God is. It's a story about the presence of God in Joseph's life and how God somehow moves in the midst of these seasons of loneliness, the injustice, and the suffering. As I mentioned at the outset, it's fascinating to me that in this part of the story of Joseph that Sarah read for us this morning, there are two bookend moments where the authors seem keen to remind us that God was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love. And that somehow God worked through all of this mess, this injustice that was Joseph's experience. Somehow God worked through what happened to bring life for Joseph and then Egypt through him. Now, I think this all matters because it helps us understand something about the character of God. God isn't the kind of God up there pulling strings to teach us morality lessons. God is the God who over and over again comes into the mess of life with us and whose presence is about bringing life out of the mess. With God, Joseph finds a way forward, finds a future, despite what had to have been the unmistakable feeling of no future. In the letter that Paul writes to Rome, he writes this: "We know that all things work together for good." And I think that perhaps this is the lens through which we should read this story of Joseph. With all of the tragedy and loss that comes to Joseph, all of the desolation and things that drag him under, God is with Joseph and works to bring all things together for good. And I've said this before, but notice it does not say all things are good, but that all things work together for good. I think it's a really important distinction. Because despite what we are sometimes told or perhaps sold, the life of faith is not the absence of struggle or suffering or grief or hardship, but I think rather the ongoing process of learning to attune our hearts and our minds, our spirits to the God who is present with us in the mess and the struggle, and trusting that somehow along the way these things will work all together for good. And as with Joseph, it's not just our own good, but others as well. So much so that while not in the moment, but at some point looking back over the months or years, we might just be able to see the ways in which God was with us. The way that God had weaved together the good and the bad such that we prosper. And not prosper in that sort of capitalist sense that we have more stuff, that we have more money or power or resources, that we rise to the next rung on the ladder. But prosper in the sense that we have a qualitatively different faith, different life, different hope, different love. You see, what this story of Joseph, I think, helps us grasp is that the life of faith is not a freedom from struggle, a freedom from suffering, but the confidence that somehow God will, in the end, draw life out of it. That's what resurrection is all about. God pulling life out of death? Now, of course, we need to be careful, because this could easily be taken as some sort of pithy dismissal of all of our experiences, as if to say, don't worry, it's not that bad, because God's going to make it all better. But that's not what I'm saying. This is about how we are not alone. That no matter what our experience, God is with us, as the psalmist writes, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for God is with me. Several years after my dad passed away, I was helping my mom pack up her house for a not insignificant move from Lincoln, Nebraska to Chicago. And among the many, many things that we put into boxes, I came across some old VHS tapes. Raise of hands, who knows what those are? And not surprisingly, my mom also still had a VCR. And not just a VCR stuffed into a closet, but it was actually still plugged into a TV. So I put in one of these tapes and discovered that it was a tape of my dad, who had died in 2006. It was the first time I had seen or heard him since he died, kind of in live action sort of way. But the tape I found was of a cancer support group that my dad went to regularly throughout the years. And at that point in time, it was a unique thing to have a support group for cancer survivors. And so they were filming it to show others how it worked, I guess. And at one point, my dad is talking to the group, and the leader of the group asked him something. He said, the leader of the group asked, if you could, would you go back and make it so you never had cancer? It seems like somewhat of a silly question, I think, but I suppose there's something helpful about it. And my dad, without hesitation, says, no, absolutely not. I had heard him say this before. It's not an uncommon question, I guess, but he would always say no. And his response to the next question, the next obvious question, why, was always the same. He would say something to the effect of, because the lens through which I view and experience life now is so radically different. The experience and gratitude I have now for life, for God, for family, for friends, is something I never would have had I not had these experiences with cancer. And I wouldn't change anything. It always caught me off guard to hear my dad say this, because I know what those experiences were like for him. I know what he had been through. So I always was a little, honestly, I was always a little unconvinced by his answer. And yet there, he was looking back through it all, the good and the bad, the joy and the pain, and he could see how God had somehow worked it all together for good. And how God had, along the way, helped him to prosper. And not with wealth or the accumulation of things, but with faith and with hope and with life. I'll be honest, as I look back at those years and my experience of them as an 8, 9, 10-year-old, I'm not quite in a place to say the same thing. Most days, I think I would absolutely say that I would have changed it. It's not the easiest thing to navigate your dad having those and how much that changes your life. But even still, as I look back, I can see the ways that God was with us in it. Most evidently through others who cared for, loved, held us in those years. And I do hope, and most days trust, that a day is coming when I will be able to see how God worked all those things together for good, not just through my dad's eyes, but through mine as well. And I think I'm finally, along the way, beginning to understand where my professor was coming from. when he said, "No, when I start class that way, when I say, 'The Lord be with you,' I mean it every time." I think I'm beginning to understand that saying, "The Lord be with you," is not just something we say to get to the passing of the peace, or to fill space, or because it sounds like something we should do in worship. No, I think those seemingly simple words are ultimately so rich and heavy with meaning and blessing. Because you see, it's a way of saying to one another, in the mess and the muck of life, in the joy and the celebrations, in the pain and the suffering, may God be with you. May you feel and be sustained by the love and grace of God. Maybe it's in a meal shared. Maybe a hand held, a silly conversation with a friend, the majesty of creation, or as with Joseph, a prison guard. However it happens, may God be with you. And as impossible as it might seem in the moment, trust that somehow God is working all of these things together for good. God is working to make a way out of no way, so much so that on most days we have confidence that at some point along the way, it may take years or decades, your whole life, perhaps we may not even witness the fruit in our lifetime, but God is a God of resurrection. And even now, God is working all things together for good. Because nothing is so powerful that it can nullify the promises of God. That is the stubbornness of God's grace. And so, dear friends, the Lord be with you. Amen.